You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about a hungry composter at UW Green Bay that's keeping thousands of pounds of food waste out of landfills. First, a recent story by Axios is raising the issue of how China is working to gain access to influential U.S. politicians. Last week, it reported on a suspected Chinese spy who developed close relationships with local and national leaders. That includes Democratic Congressman and 2020 presidential candidate Eric Swalwell of California. The operation reportedly ran from 2011 to 2015. The woman at the center of that story is named Fang Fang, or Christine Fang. Among other means, she had romantic relationships reportedly with at least two Midwestern mayors. Swalwell said he cut ties with her after being alerted by federal investigators of her activities. She then left the country. U.S. officials don't believe she received or passed on any classified info, nor have they accused Swalwell of wrongdoing. So how big a national security threat is China, and what might the incoming Biden administration do about it? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about China as an international competitor for the United States? What would you like to see President-elect Biden do when it comes to issues related to China, espionage, trade, and more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Gallagher is a professor of political science and director of the International Institute at the University of Michigan. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So we have this Axios report on a Chinese spy here. How much does this tell us about the state of relationships between the U.S. and China and efforts, I guess, from China to spy on us here in the United States?
Well, the story is interesting, and I mean, I think it bears pointing out that all countries, including the United States, spy on other countries. But I think what's really important about what's happening with Chinese efforts here is that they are getting more sophisticated, and they're extending much more into what I would call influence operations, which I think are a little bit different than espionage. Sometimes it's called non-traditional espionage, so using people like this woman, Christine Fang, to start to understand American politics in a more sophisticated way, and also to perhaps have influence on domestic politics in the United States.
Now, we're talking today after this big Russian cyber campaign apparently was detected, targeting a lot of government agencies. How does China stack up when it compares to espionage efforts here in the United States to countries like Russia and elsewhere?
I think the research that's been done and some of the comparisons show that up until recently, Russia was, particularly in the 2016 election with social media campaigns, that Russia was far more sophisticated in understanding the polarization and the cleavages in American politics, particularly around race, and could use that effectively in social media to polarize people both on the left and the right. China traditionally has not been very good at it, but it, you know, I think it's really trying to improve and probably learning from Russia. The real difference, I think, and the more important issue that I think I'm concerned about is that because of the large number of Chinese Americans in the United States, that often these influence operations are via Chinese Americans who obviously are U.S. citizens and, you know, should take part in American politics. And this was really obvious in the story that you mentioned regarding Eric Swalwell in terms of the woman involved who later left the country was operating through Asian American organizations, including some at her university. So it's this ability to kind of cannibalize or to capitalize on these organizations that are completely normal and are completely legal through an affiliation with Chinese Americans.
And we've seen reports from around the world, not just in the United States, of Chinese intelligence agencies putting pressure on especially more recent immigrants or students or others from China with possible threats to their families back in China. How big a problem has this been, not just in the United States, but elsewhere?
This is a big problem as well, although I see it as somewhat separate from this issue of influence operations and non-traditional espionage. I think what happens most often for Chinese students or Chinese nationals who are in the United States, if if they are getting involved in some way in Chinese domestic politics, maybe posting on social media, whether or not they like their own government, and then returning to China and being prosecuted or having their parents or relatives threatened while they're still here. And that has a huge impact on Chinese students at American universities. There's a lot of Chinese students in Michigan. There's a fair number at Wisconsin as well. And that's a big concern. And I think it's something that American universities need to pay more attention to make our campuses really continuing to be open and to have the academic freedom and the freedom of speech that every student deserves. And Chinese students don't feel that if they feel like their parents can be threatened while they're here, but their parents are in China.
From the American perspective, are there ways we can effectively counter, the American government, I guess, counter a Chinese-led influence campaign without unfairly targeting the vast majority of Chinese Americans, of Chinese immigrants, and the students you just mentioned unfairly with discrimination?
I think we can, although I think it takes a fair amount of work and attention. I think there are certain things that we could do as universities and within the government. So for example, the FBI has an initiative called the China Initiative, which is looking at non-traditional espionage at American universities and corporations and elsewhere, often targeting ethnic Chinese, although also sometimes also finding and prosecuting non-Chinese. And I think it's really important for the U.S. government to be clear that the vast, vast majority of Chinese students and scholars in the United States, there's over a million of them, have nothing to do with non-traditional espionage. And in most cases, particularly undergraduates, which make up a big portion of these students, these are students who have chosen to come to the United States for higher education and are willing to pay for it. And these students, in a sense, are the students that are seeking our environment out. They're seeking out a more open academic environment. They're seeking a more open political environment, and they shouldn't be punished for that. And so I think there needs to be a more targeted approach in terms of looking at individuals. So obviously undergraduates have not been rounded up in at all in great numbers. And I think that should be clear in terms of who is actually being affected by these campaigns by the U.S. government to root out non-traditional espionage. I think it might also be more effective to target the organizations that are often used by the Chinese government to facilitate non-traditional espionage. And that these organizations often have very close ties to the Chinese embassies and the Chinese consulates. Rather than targeting individuals, really look at the nodes and the networks that the government is often allowed to establish in the United States, taking advantage of the fact that we have a more open environment for associations and for civil society in general.
Talking to Mary Gallagher from the University of Michigan, looking at recent reports of Chinese espionage in the United States and wider issues of the relationships between the United States and China. And Mary, I've seen people, think of China as mainly a trade rival to the United States, others as a strategic rival to the United States. Can you sum up a little bit about the state of relationships between the two countries?
Well, the state of the relationship right now is probably the lowest it's been since we established diplomatic relations with China in 1979. And it's a rivalry that is really starting to approach the rivalry that we had with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But I don't think we should think of it simply as a new Cold War, because our relationship with China is so much more sophisticated and interdependent than our relationship was with the Soviet Union. And not to mention, the Soviet Union was not a major economic power. I mean, it was a major military power. It was obviously a superpower vis-a-vis the Cold War, but it simply did not have the same capacity that the peer that China does today. So it is a rivalry across all fronts. It's about ideology. It's about, is an authoritarian system better, particularly in this era of COVID? Is it somehow more effective at dealing with these crises? It's a military rivalry. It's also a technological rivalry.
The hope when trade was opened up with China, I think the going argument was bringing some capitalism into an authoritarian regime will inevitably or almost certainly loosen things up. It will create a middle class that will advocate for more freedoms and lead to a more open society. That it seems like now pretty much everyone has given up on that idea. I think, Marian, people are rethinking how that's working out.
It is true. I think people have given up. And it was obvious even at the end of the Obama administration when some Obama-era officials wrote an essay basically summarizing that argument that engagement with China has failed. I want to push back on that a little bit, because I think if you do look at things like the middle class, which is now over 200 million people, at least in China, probably more, and also the society. I mean, it's a much more open society than it certainly was in the 1980s when I first went to China as a college student myself. It has become more closed and more repressive under Xi Jinping, who's the current president, took office in 2013. But I don't think we should give up on engagement entirely. Not to mention, we really can't give up on engagement entirely, because giving up on engagement could mean, unless it's done really carefully, will isolate the United States at its expense and would allow China to continue to expand its sort of global aspirations and its global ambitions. So I don't think it's this, I don't think we can just give up on engagement, but we have to do it much more carefully. And I think with a lot more strategic vision about what the United States wants to become.
We're looking at China, espionage, and the U.S.-China relationship with Mary Gallagher, professor of political science and director of the Center for Chinese Studies at the University of Michigan. We'll get into more of what that more nuanced approach could look like in just a bit. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see China as a big threat to our national security, to our economy? What kind of approach would you like to see the incoming Biden administration take towards China? Should it continue what President Trump's been doing on trade and other issues? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now we're talking about U.S.-China relations. Axios reported last week that a suspected Chinese spy got in close proximity to many American politicians from 2011 to 2015, and we're looking at how the incoming Biden administration may approach China. Mary Gallagher is our guest. She's a professor of political science and director of the International Institute at the University of Michigan. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Mary, what would a more positive kind of engagement, a more strategic kind of engagement look like, especially with a new presidential administration on the way?
I think, President Biden, as he comes into office, is probably going to have to take a much not necessarily similar to Trump in terms of execution, but I think in terms of holding a pretty strict line on some of these policies that the Trump administration started to adopt. I think the Biden administration is probably not going to roll back those anytime soon very easily, because the concerns haven't gone away. And like I said, I think some of the concerns were already being articulated at the end of the Obama administration. I think there are some things that the United States can do that can better put forth a kind of positive view of the American political system and the American role abroad traditionally. And most importantly, of course, would be to work with other allies that I think there's a lot of common ground. The issues with China, particularly with the EU and then allies in Asia like South Korea and Japan, those connections to our allies really fractured under the Trump administration, and I think they need to be rebuilt. There are other issues related to trade where I think the United States should begin to restart negotiations with other Asian countries for some sort of multilateral trade agreement, although I think it'll be very difficult because there's a lot of concerns about labor and environmental regulations. But even restarting those talks and being a good actor in those talks, I think will be important. And then on issues related to climate change, obviously Biden has already talked about re-entering the Paris Climate Agreement. And I think that might be an area for the United States to begin to talk directly with China about the two largest economies in the world really starting to adopt some similar policies related to climate change. China sees, the Chinese government sees issues like climate change as a business opportunity. They see it as a way to transform their economy. They don't see it necessarily as the same way that in the United States is often perceived as a new way in which regulation and government oversight is going to hurt business. They really see it as a way to subsidize their industries, like in clean energy and in autonomous vehicles and in electric vehicles. So I think we need to start, you know, actually thinking about crises like climate change as a way in which to transform our own industries.
You mentioned trying to have some kind of trade agreement with other Asian partners. We had the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the works in the 2016 election. It looked like poison. Then candidate Donald Trump attacked it. Then candidate Senator Bernie Sanders attacked it. Hillary Clinton had to move away from it. And is there the political will in the United States to do anything that, I know, even sounds like a Trans-Pacific Partnership retry?
I think the reason why it might be more doable now than then, and I agree, that's exactly what happened. Even Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State and was one of the architects of the TPP, had to back down and disavow it. Biden, when he campaigned, said that he would be interested in renegotiating it. So I assume that is probably something that will happen. What's changed, I think, is that China, once the United States has withdrawn from the international community and became much more isolationist, China fills the void. I don't know if the American population wants China to fill the void, but if we don't do something in regards to trade, then it will fill the void. And it's already started to sign multilateral and bilateral trade treaties with a lot of our allies in the region and also other countries in the region that we traditionally have had close ties with. So I think we need to think about this as a competition. And if we don't fill the gap somehow, then China will fill the gap and we will be further affected negatively by the balance of power as it swings in China's direction.
Talking to Mary Gallagher from the University of Michigan, looking at U.S.-China relations. Staying with trade, one of the big stories over the last 4 years, a couple years ago, it really hit a peak, was the rising trade dispute, dueling tariffs back and forth between the U.S. and China over agricultural goods and many other things, too. What have we settled into? What's been the resolution on that?
Well, I mean, the trade war that was started under the Trump administration raised tariffs dramatically for both. We raised tariffs and then they retaliated. Those costs have been passed on to American consumers and higher prices. For agricultural producers in the Midwest, they've lost a key customer and they probably will not regain that customer very quickly as China has found new partners in Brazil and Australia for things that they used to buy from the United States. I think I think there were a lot of issues related to trade that the Trump administration rightly brought up. And there was a lot of anger in the United States over the broader opening to China and the loss of manufacturing jobs in places like the upper Midwest. The Trump administration could not bring those jobs back. And that was a big failure of the trade war, I think. So I think there needs to be a more strategic approach, an approach that doesn't just rely on tariffs and also an approach that isn't just unilateral.
And there's a sense, I think, among a lot of people around the world that in many ways, China doesn't play fair one way or another in the trade market, whether it's subsidies for their own companies or intellectual property concerns in the past, currency manipulation, that kind of thing. are there ways to enforce a level playing field with China when it comes to international trade?
I think the issues of intellectual property can be done multilaterally. I think also the issues of subsidies, there's a much more sophisticated view of them now, and a way in which to understand how they work in China and also how they don't work, because they can also create a lot of inefficiencies in the Chinese economy. But I don't think any of these issues can be done by the United States by itself. And the tactic of only using tariffs, as we've seen since 2018 with the trade war, hasn't really solved those key issues. They've made goods here more expensive, but the trade deficit with China continues to grow, particularly as they've recovered from COVID so much more quickly. And we sit at home, you know, buying goods made in China over the internet.
As we wrap up, Mary, what are you watching for, especially in the early months of the new Biden administration, to see what the approach is going to be to China?
I think one of the things that I'm really interested in seeing is how Biden articulates the Democratic Party's traditional emphasis on protection of human rights, because I think this is where China has acted really egregiously, not just in its in its own country related to the Muslim minority in Xinjiang, but also in the special administrative zone of Hong Kong, which has had its one country, two systems completely obliterated this year with the national security law. And then also just overreach generally, a real bullying kind of diplomacy vis-a-vis Australia. I think the United States really needs to play a leading role in standing up to that kind of behavior. And that's an area where both the Trump administration and then the previous Obama administration, I think, just ceded way too much ground.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mary Gallagher is professor of political science and director of the Center for Chinese Studies at the University of Michigan. Talked to her about Chinese espionage efforts in the U.S. and what the incoming Biden administration's approach to China might look like. Imagine what tens of thousands of pounds of food waste might look like. Now imagine that food waste in a landfill. Thanks to a new large-scale composter on UW Green Bay's campus, a lot of dining hall food waste is not going to a landfill, but will instead become usable compost. Guillermo Gomez is a UW Green Bay senior and president of the Student Government Association there. Guillermo, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've got a compost bin in my backyard. I put a bucket of food or so, or, you know, food waste or so in it every week. But paint us a picture of this big guy on the UW Green Bay campus.
You know, the most fascinating thing to me about the composter is it kind of just looks like a giant shipping container. And to people not familiar with it, that's what they'll probably assume it is. But it's essentially a giant shipping container anyways. We have a pile of wood chips outside. And we have our hundreds of pounds of food waste indoors, and we have our student workers bring that food waste outside. They put in some wood chips in there. They put in the food waste. And I believe we put about between 300 and 320 pounds of compost in there every single day on average, which equals about 2,100 pounds a week, which is a lot of food.
That is a lot. Yeah. And can you talk about some of the benefits that are coming from this in addition to, you know, just not wasting so much stuff? What do we end up getting out of the bin?
So this is actually really interesting for us because we've been trying to work on more sustainability projects for a long time now. And this composter is a really good thing for that. We're able to work with our environmental organizations on campus. Environmental policy and planning majors, classrooms, and, you know, we're able to give them this opportunity to work with a composter, but also we're going to be hiring two sustainability interns or two sustainability workers in the union to help with the composter. So we're bringing jobs to campus. We're helping with some classroom stuff, and we're able to give some people and organizations the chance to have some hands-on experience with it.
As I understand it, this was a student-led and student-funded effort. How did it come to pass?
So we've actually this has been years and years in the making. Our sustainability fund was created, I think, well over a decade ago, and it was created in order to eventually work on a project as large as this. And so, you know, it's built up tens of thousands of dollars. We've been able to work with the University Union on securing the rest of the funding we needed for that, because we had the we essentially had all of the funding for it, but we needed some logistics in place. But yeah, this fund has been funded for years and years and years.
Now, if I'm a student, am I taking my leftover tray after lunch and walking over to the ginormous composter and doing it? Or does it, you know, happen kind of at a remove from my daily experience?
So as long as you're not directly walking out to the composter, normal students will just be able to go into the cafeteria and throw away food waste as they would normally. And then the kitchen staff will be the ones that are sorting the food waste and bringing it out for some of the University Union employees to actually take out. So students probably will not have too much hands-on experience with the composter in that regard.
Where is the compost going to end up being used?
So we have a couple plans for it. Eventually, we want to be able to we want to be able to build a garden. We want to be able to use some of that. We want to be able to use some mulch, and we want to make sure that the compost is actually being put to good use. Because before, obviously, we didn't have a composter. And, you know, now we're trying to figure out what are the best ways we can actually use all of this. What are the best ways we can, you know, make everything sustainable? And so, I've been talking to a couple of people in the union about getting a nice big garden that we're able to put some of this to use for.
Well, no, and I know on the UW Green Bay campus, you've got those tunnels. You don't have to go outside quite as much this time of year if you don't want to. Is this giving you something to look forward to, a way to, in the spring, start using this stuff and hopefully get a garden going?
Oh yeah, it's really exciting, honestly. Before getting involved in this project, I really didn't know a whole lot about composting, but you know, it's just a really exciting thing to be able to do.
And this is part of UW Green Bay is being an EcoU university. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure we've been an EcoU campus for almost 50 years now, and you know, obviously we've had a really great commitment to environmental action. But there's always something more you can do, you know?
Do you have a next step in our last few moments, a follow-up project?
About the composter, it's kind of up in the air. Obviously, with COVID, there's a lot of things halted. We eventually want to have some sort of grand opening composter ceremony and bring more students into the mix and get more students involved. So that's probably what we'll be doing next.
Guillermo, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Guillermo Gomez is a senior at UW Green Bay, president of the Student Government Association there. We talked to him about the new mega composter on the campus, how it's helping reduce the amount of food waste going to landfills. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a profile about a renowned music producer with Milwaukee roots.
Cheryl Pavelski says she was born hardwired to love music because of her musical family. She found an even deeper connection by collecting records, purchasing her first 45s on a trip to Gimbel's department store in Milwaukee. Pavelski is now a Grammy Award-winning producer who lives in Los Angeles and one of the founders of Omnivore Recordings. Andy Turner recently talked with the industry veteran about her musical journey.
Growing up in Milwaukee, with vinyl records piling up in her room by the time she was a teenager, Cheryl Pavelski has always loved music.
Until, you know, COVID kneecapped everything, there was an excuse to dance and play music and drink beer probably every night of the year in Milwaukee. So, but for me personally, I was obsessed early on with records, the actual physical things and how they were made.
She spent a lot of time in record stores, like the nearby Mean Mountain Music.
You pop open the door to that place and you would hear anything from Louis Jordan to Doris Day. You know, all these guys hanging around, chain smoking, shooting the breeze, looking like they walked off the set of Happy Days. And then I come in rolling up on my bike, you know, looking for like some Jump Blues 45 or something.
She started to first understand music recordings by trading and buying tapes of mostly bootlegged concerts. The tapes would often have studio outtakes by the artist at the end to fill up time.
You have a favorite artist, and all of a sudden, at the end of a tape, a song you know really well comes on, but it's different. You know, it might be missing something. Maybe it has some different lyrics in it. That blew my mind. That was like the mystery of the universe, right? Like, how did that happen? You know?
In 1990, she moved to Los Angeles to be close to one of the centers of the music industry. Sleeping on friends' floors, she started working as a temporary worker at EMI Capitol Records. Pavelski would work her way up to senior director of A&R at Capitol and remain there until 2002 when EMI made massive cuts. She co-founded Omnivore Recordings in 2010 with the desire to set her own timetable for projects and find protection from another corporate reorganization. The releases she has produced or worked on include albums being re-released, previously unissued, compilations and box sets from Big Star, Little Richard, Miles Davis. There's also Wilco, Townes Van Zandt, Aretha Franklin.
All of these things, whether they're favorite artists of mine or their friends, you know, that's always meaningful. But some of the stuff is just, you know, like working on Stax material. Come on.
In 2014, she won a Grammy Award for producing Hank Williams' The Garden Spot Program, 1950. She recently received another nomination, her fifth, for the 2021 Grammy Awards for It's Such a Good Feeling, the best of Mr. Rogers. The historical significance of preserving the music she helps bring out into the world appeals to Pavelski.
That's the most important thing about my job, you know, is to not let us leave some of this on the dust heap of history in the 20th century and hand it down for next generations so that they know about this music, you know.
As she anticipated the Omnivore release of a deluxe version of Wilco's 1999 album, Summer Teeth, Pavelski is delighted by the idea of giving the band's fans a gateway to the mysteries of music that have always blown her mind.
There are songs I walk around with in my head that nobody's heard since they were recorded, and they're hits up here. and I cannot wait to share those things.
Somewhere, there's a song that needs saving, and you just might find Pavelski not far behind.
Andy Turner brought us that story on Cheryl Pavelski, a Milwaukee native and co-founder of Omnivore Recordings. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Even if travel plans were disrupted this year, many of us have our favorite spots to visit during a Wisconsin summer, whether there's a certain lake in the north or a visit to the Wisconsin Dells with the kids. We might think of them as our spots, but it turns out that some of those places have been attracting tourists for a couple centuries now. Joe Kapler is the lead curator in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Division of Museums and Historic Sites. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Good afternoon. Thanks very much.
Well, when I think of Wisconsin tourism today, I might think of the Dells or lakes in northern Wisconsin, Door County. Historically, in the early days of Wisconsin, were these some of the first tourist sites to emerge in the state?
They certainly were. 1837, you could say, was kind of the first intentional effort to meet the needs of visitors and tourists. The opening of in Wisconsin Dells of a inn and tavern, specifically for visitors and travelers. But it's really the 1850s in Wisconsin, in the Dells, even the Geneva Lake area and Door County, where tourism as we think of it today really got its roots started.
And the initial draw for a lot of these places, no surprise, it seems like it was natural beauty. Was that the general trend there?
I think you can thank your favorite glaciation period for that. Absolutely. The Dells carved out by a catastrophic breach in the ice dam from a glaciation period, Geneva Lake carved out by a previous glaciation period, and of course the Door Peninsula carved out as well as all of those beautiful lakes up north in Lake Country, in Vilas County, Forest County, that area specifically. So water being the key thread in all of those areas.
Now, if it's the 1850s and I'm a would-be Wisconsin tourist, how did I get to all these places? I couldn't hop in the car, and there wasn't a road I could have driven a car on if it existed.
And there's a couple of options for you. By 1850s, you could think steamship or think boat, I should say, along Great Lakes to get perhaps take you all the way up and around to the maybe even the Ashland area, the Door Peninsula, and embark from there. 1856, the railroad reached what was Kilbourne City, or what we now know today as Wisconsin Dells. So that was big. So you could see who could get to those places, and it wasn't the common jump in the car that we think of today. So even though tourism started at that point, a relatively small amount of people with time and means to afford those long transit routes. And then this wasn't a leave work on a Friday and get home on Sunday night thing. This was people that had weeks to take off to vacation.
And how did word get out about these scenic sites? There were no internet ads or TV ads. There was no GPS to help find them. How did people, say, in Chicago or Milwaukee find out about these things?
1856, the Wisconsin Mirror, the editor included a very famous, what's now a very kind of famous and oft-quoted statement, the wild romantic scenery of the Dells will always make them a place of resort for seekers of pleasure. That was in 1856. And in the in the Dells area, they are advertising in newspapers in Chicago. So again, a very intentional effort. And later on, steamship companies in the 1870s, as the railroad is reaching places like Geneva Lake and further up north and further inland, the railroad organizations, booster associations, kind of both governmental and businesses getting together, promoting in Milwaukee and Chicago, especially. And, of course, we can't forget our own Henry Hamilton Bennett of Wisconsin Dells, incredible imagery. And that really put the Dells on the map, because all over the country, people can say their area is gorgeous and beautiful and natural splendor, but Bennett's stunning photography and the publication of it coast to coast really solidified the Dells of Wisconsin as a not only a national scale, but a world-class destination.
Talking to Joe Kapler, lead curator in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Division of Museums and Historic Sites, looking at the history of tourism here in Wisconsin, how our most famous tourist sites came to be way earlier than I would have thought. Let's fast forward a few decades, Joe, to the rise of the automobile. What kind of game changer was that for places like the Dells and the Lakes and Door County and so on?
Probably the biggest game changer. 1920s, automobiles are becoming accessible to more and more people. And the grand attempt to make up north, the cutover region and farmland, you know, failed. Not good soil and growing season, apparently, for up there. But wow, all these wonderful lakes, the remaining forests and the forests regenerating appealed to so many. So roads are booming, not the interstates that we're thinking of today. That's 50s and 60s, but even in the 1920s. So an explosion in volume. I think in 1922, the ferry at Sturgeon Bay, July 4th, had a 2,200 cars, I think, or something like that. My numbers are probably a little bit off. 5 years later, Memorial Day weekend, 35,000 people crossing. So, you know, that's a massive increase. The same with up north. And so it also, you know, it brought family visitors. It shortened up the time. You didn't have to pack your trunks and stay for weeks. It could, the automobile allowed you and me and your neighbors and friends and family to take much shorter trips and get much further into these lakes that are tucked away further and deeper into the forests.
And did I read? I think it was on the Historical Society website. Before the amenities developed, people would just drive along and they'd just camp in somebody's farm field or something like that, which did not make them popular initially with the locals.
They're auto camps alongside the roads, and initially, you know, free. And, you know, well-intentioned, pitch a tent, have some latrines there, that type of a thing, but a victim of their own success, really tough on county budgets. And, you know, in the 1920s, you really start to see the issue, kind of the tug and pull of competing interests and the managing the impact of large-scale visitation. So you start to see visitors coming in and leaving, and maybe not having a huge impact on the positive side of the tax base, but drawing resources. And you really start to see it there. And then, you know, taxes on hotel rooms and things like that to account for it. And it brought to light the issue of whose resources are these and who gets to benefit the most. And not specifically a Wisconsin story, but a major story here, given the enormous natural resources that we have, and so much of our state is amenable for visitation and tourists. And there's always been the back and forth and the tug and pull and the adjustment to visitation.
So this, a lot of the things we think of as standbys in tourism, the places and later the amenities, a lot of them are still there in modern form. What do you see as the biggest change since the early days of tourism in Wisconsin to 2020?
Water is always going to be the draw, and you know, I've lived in 6 Midwestern states, and it's not the same elsewhere, that is for sure. You know, the water and the certainly the summer climate is world class, and it always will be. The biggest difference here today in 2020, you might come for the water, and I hope that you see a lake, and I hope you dip your toes in the water. But the so many other services, entertainment options for you, great, you know, eating and drinking, all of those opportunities are there for you 24/7 in many places, and also, you know, year round in many places as well. Really catering, full service. So if there's a dip somewhere in the economy with family visitation, well, you still might have sports camps, or you still have the summer camps, or you have, you know, the business retreats and all of that. So the tourism base has really widened its stance and is on, you know, firmer ground, so to speak. And I think that's, you know, the major change between now and a long time ago. But the reason is we're a beautiful state, and that will always be a draw.
Joe, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It's good to talk with you.
Joe Kapler is lead curator in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Division of Museums and Historic Sites. He joined us to talk about the history of tourism here in the state. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, the COVID-19 pandemic has hit all types of states and regions in the U.S. from coast to coast and urban to rural. But some states have done better than others, with much lower death rates per capita. Is it just good luck, or are there lessons to be learned from those states? Join Kate and her guests for a look at what's working. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Wisconsin's electoral votes for president are in. We'll talk about what happens between now and Inauguration Day and what the aftermath of the election means for our politics in the future. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.